who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings, and I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec. Spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chojage, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy, recording from home on Thursday, August 11th, 2022. A retro show tonight. This week's archive show looks back on some of my favorite conversations so far this year on movement, tap, stepping, and circus. On tonight's show, my guests. Travis Knight is an ambassador of the hidden history of jazz and tap and black artists, but insists that at the end of the day, he sees his job as pretty straightforward.
I've traveled the world. I've lived here and there. I've toured. It's all great. I've been blessed. Fantastic. But at the beginning and the end of every day, what it all boils down to is the dance itself. And everything else is cute.
Meet Kyan Quealy, the founder of Montreal's own stepping troupe, and how the rhythmic dance form was born through the fight for freedom and community.
Stepping is so linked to what happened in 1739 in South Carolina, where there was the Stono Rebellion and they took away the use of the drums and instruments. And it gave way to people exploring and using their bodies even more to create, to express, to resist.
Crafting intimacy over a dozen feet in the air, Norwegian aerialist Hege Eriksdottir Osterfjells on her show Plast.
But we wanted to create material where we could connect with each other rather than the audience being blown away by huge tricks. We wanted to see the human connection.
Now on with the show. When he was a child, Travis Knight tried every group sport, or at least his parents forced him to. But Travis eventually found his way to another kind of physical activity, the world of jazz and tap. The Montrealer studied under legendary teacher Ethel Bruno. But Travis seeks more than just to perform and entertain. He is passionate about sharing the incontrovertible black history of the dance form, from origins as a form of communications in the South to vaudeville halls to Hollywood screens to today. Even though he sometimes has to push back on the idea that tap might be passé as an art. Travis centers his practice as a black performance art, taking a non-Eurocentric lens and exploring the tangibility of dance tradition, hence his new show titled Ephemeral Artifacts, the idea that dance is here and now, but lasts with you forever. Travis performed this show at the Mai this spring. Here is our conversation. I want to say this, we're on Zoom right now. I'm seeing you. You're wearing your beautiful red button-up shirt, and there's a shoe. Your left hand, my right hand corner, right in front of the frame. And it's a tap shoe.
Yeah, and never leave home without them. That's the very first thing my teacher Ethel Bruno taught me. You know, as soon as you learn how to interesting part of the negotiation.
Why is it important to always have a pair of shoes with you? Is it because you never want to pass up an opportunity, or is it more about just always being, you know, ready to perform? Or
fantastic. It's like it's a lifestyle, you know. I am a tap dancer. Like I'm not even joking. People, producers that I talk with a lot, think that they laugh. that's cute. But I want to reduce my bio to just say Travis Knights is a tap dancer. Period. All of the other stuff that's great, and I've done a lot. I've traveled the world. I've lived here and there. I've toured. It's all great. I've been blessed. Fantastic. But at the beginning and the end of every day, what it all boils down to is the dance itself, and everything else is cute.
Everything else is gravy.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's better. Yeah.
This is so funny to me because I'm always under the impression that the longer your bio is, the better, the more projects you tack on, the more things you've done, you know, but for you, it's all about one word.
Yeah. Tap dance. I feel like the dance is its own high praise, high art. It's its own thing. And let's not mince words here. I don't want to give the impression that I am not impressed with people's bios. I don't want to give the impression like I don't become like the biggest fanboy for like specific people that I put up on pedestals. And it's related to what I've seen them do. It's related to this history that I've built up with them. But when it comes to tap dance, people rarely see it, you know? And I kind of enjoy the opportunity to come in completely bare and give you a first impression beyond film and television, a first impression of what live tap dance is. I love that experience for audiences.
We'll get into the first impressions you're giving out in this incredible show in just a moment, but you mentioned Ethel Bruno, who is a teacher of yours, and that's where I wanted to start your journey to tap and to dance, and consequently you coming across Ethel. Tell me about that.
I don't think I had a choice in the matter. I really believe that like the dance chose me. So at the time I'm like 9 years old, I'm 8 years old, and I'm socially inept. I've got no skills. I don't understand people. And quite frankly, I'm afraid of them. And so my parents wisely said, oh, you know, this is a problem. We're social animals. We should, team sports. So they put me in hockey, horrible. Baseball, marginally better, but still horrible. And then I saw Gregory Hines performing on stage. He was, at the time, he was doing a tribute to Sammy Davis Jr., who was, Sammy was sick at the time, he was dying of cancer. And all of Hollywood came out, like Eddie Murphy hosted the show, Stevie Wonder was on the gig, Michael Jackson was on the gig. Then here comes Gregory Hines doing something that I've seen before, but not like that, not like that. So he did this amazing impassioned speech telling Sammy how much he appreciated him, how much he means, how much the influence. And then he tap dances, phenomenal. But then this at the time he was very, very small. He lost a lot of weight, Sammy, but he put on his tap shoes and it's like all of the sickness disappeared. He went up on stage and they communicated together, tapathetically speaking. They had like a rhythm exchange and I was sold. Right away, I went to my parents. Next year was going to be soccer. Nah, please, 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 tap dance. And it's another miracle that I got hooked up with Ethel Bruno, who's originally from Harlem, New York. And you have to understand that tap dance is a Black cultural art form, and it was like a central element to the Harlem Renaissance in terms of the artists and the explosion of culture then. And so to be taught from Ethel Bruno, a daughter of the Harlem Renaissance. It just like, I had no choice. From that point when I'm 10 years old to speaking to you right now, it's just a straight line of passion and hardcore geekdom on foot-based percussive rhythm. Yeah.
You see yourself as a direct inheritance, like that you're keeping alive a seed from the Harlem Renaissance, you know, from Ethel to you onto whoever you're teaching next. Like, is that real for you?
Absolutely. It's real. It's important. And it's the reason why, you know, coming back to that bio conversation, like everything else is kind of noise. Tap dance benefits from being hyper popular back in the day, but it also suffers from being hyper popular back in the day because, you know, during the Harlem Renaissance, you had Black people moving from the South to the North during the Great Migration. And they're taking, you know, the rhythms that are coming from New Orleans is mixing with what's happening in Kansas City, Chicago, and then they land, some of them, a critical mass, land in Harlem. And you have these different cultures of people, all of them considered Black, right? But they have these different cultures of people mixing together. You have musicians and singers and dancers and poets and visual artists mixing together. And that scene, the culture that was formed, exploded all over the world. It's called jazz, right? And so for me, it's more than, for me, I think show business is a distraction, right? It's a way to commodify what I've dedicated my life to, but the culture is what gives life. The culture is what inspired people to come in and be tourists in Harlem, and then take the choreography that they learned and put it on Hollywood screens. The culture is at risk of dying, right? I'm one of only a handful of Black tap dancers in Canada. And that there's a lot of reasons for that, but I do consider it a part of my mission, a part of my journey to help rectify that, to reintroduce tap dance to the Black community here in Canada and around the world.
That is the voice of Travis Knights, who is a dancer first and foremost, but also a creator as well, presenting Ephemeral Artifacts Travis Knight by his company Anundam at the Mai this week. And it's so funny that you're touching on all of this and talking about, you know, the commodification of a dance form, but also how it gets transmitted to a larger community. But at the same time, you're saying it's at risk. The title of your show, Ephemeral Artifacts, points out the fact that, you know, being on stage, it is ephemeral. It is in the moment. So maybe we can get into the show itself by pointing to these two words, ephemeral artifacts, and elaborating a little bit more there.
Yeah, I love it. It's an oxymoron that I really enjoy. Ephemeral, here today, meaning here today, gone tomorrow, basically. Artifact, here. Period. It's linked to history. The tap dance, as it was taught to me, is very much a part of an oral tradition, which means it's just passed on from one person to another. I have a drop. So hold on, let's back up. What I'm saying right now about tap dance is largely informed by hip hop, right? Hip hop, in terms of the birth of it, has been well documented, and it is also hyper popular. And in terms of the music, it's gone all over the world. And so I see tap dance as a cautionary tale for people that currently enjoy hip hop. You know, it's been commodified. It's not necessarily in that community anymore. In the community that birthed it, it's global. It's a global culture for those who choose to engage with it as a culture. But the values that are in hip hop are very similar to the values that were in jazz culture back at the Harlem Renaissance. And so in terms of the responsibility I feel to sharing this thing, it's all over the show. You know, Ephemeral Artifacts is a way for me to share the value system of this form, of this culture. People say, you know, tap dance. What? You're a tap dancer? What does that mean? What do you do? I'm about to explain it this weekend in a way that hopefully is wholesome, you know, fulfilling, and clear.
That is the voice of Travis Knights, who's, as he's saying, about to present something pretty spectacular this weekend. You mentioned that the art form is at risk. You mentioned just now someone saying to you, you're a tap dancer. What is that? Yeah. Why is it at risk? Is it because the form has been superseded by other forms, or is it a matter of trends? How do you see that? You said it was a complicated answer. So
yeah, complicated answer.
Yeah.
So like, I'm gonna attack. Look at me. I'm in my B-boy stance right now. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna attack the idea of trends first. So with trends, now we're linked to the economy. We're linked to the market. And, you know, trends come and they go. But when something is a cultural expression, then it's actually important to the way a culture operates, to the value systems of a person, of a human being. It's a longer answer. The dance is at risk because it has a complicated history. Let's do the Coles notes. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be long-winded. Okay. 1739, in the Carolinas, there was a rebellion. It's called the Stono Rebellion. And the Africans used drums to communicate across plantations to say, now's the time. And they, you know, they killed the masters and they went from plantation to plantation to plantation. Eventually, that rebellion was squashed. The next year, 1740, they passed something called the Negro Act, which restricted, banned the use of drums in that particular region of what was then still the 13 colonies, right? And so what happened to those ancestral rhythms, those African rhythms, were transferred corporeally, and a form called buck dancing began. Bucks is what they called enslaved Africans back in the day, buck dancing. Buck dancing became, over time, known as buck and wing dancing. And then buck and wing became, bam, tap dance. Very much an African diasporic form. What happened in the beginning of the 1800s, though, is the beginning of appropriation. So you had people that went onto the plantations to see what these Africans were doing. Then they blackened their face and performed minstrel shows. And it was a form of propaganda for everybody that learned about propaganda that was used in Germany during World War II. Minstrel shows were propaganda that lasted for 100 years toward all over the United States, Canada, Europe, among many other places. I think even Australia. So this practice has contributed greatly to a negative aesthetic of Black people and a negative opinion of Black people among Black people. Okay, so all this to say, you have an amazing artist like Bill Bojangles Robinson, who refuses to wear blackface, who breaks the two-color rule. That's another issue. We won't even go there, but he's a pioneer, is what I'm saying. At the height of his career, he is the highest paid Black performer in America, full stop. However, after he dies, civil rights movement happens, the Black Power movement happens. And even though he's not wearing blackface, he still has this minstrel aesthetic, an aesthetic of his time. And so Black people turned back, looked at Bill Bojangles Robinson and said, no, 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 and sacrificed tap dance, which at the time was already appropriated through minstrel shows, vaudeville, Hollywood television, Hollywood movies and television. So Black people just took a step back, several steps back, and transformed the culture into something else. The information wasn't necessarily lost, but it was transformed into something else. And to me, I'll say this. Today, we're in a period of reclamation. We're reclaiming what is ours. We're reclaiming culture. We're reclaiming our identity. We are writing our own stories. And so I'm going to use the word again. I do feel in my position, it is my responsibility to share this form with as many people that will take it in, but specifically Black people.
I could listen to you talk about this for hours, like in a grand like kind of thesis exploration, I swear, because you explained that in such a beautiful way that I think anybody who's seen one tap performance would be able to really understand. So I thank you for that. And I did want to ask about the show itself and this really cool function that you're making it really easy for people who are hard of hearing or deaf to experience the show. And you've been highlighting the importance of the percussive element of tap. So tell me about these vests and how you're opening up this to a new set of audience, a new audience.
I love it. So listen, to any artist out there listening, I highly recommend that you include a budget line in your grant to research accessibility for whatever community that you can think of. We were funded to do research on these vibro-tactile systems where they hook a microphone up to my shoe and the signal is sent to these vibrating pads. Think about, you know, for those of you that play Xbox or PlayStation or, you know, you've been to the newest Marvel movie in one of those D-Box chairs. You know what I'm talking about? It's just this, it opens up a more sensory, another way to experience the dance, I'll put it that way. I'll push even further. When we did the research in Toronto with these systems, we invited a deaf and hard of hearing crowd, and the reactions were intense for me. It was intense for me. One of the One of the participants, she said after the performance that it felt like a new sense was being opened to her. And as she was saying it, she started to tear up. A phenomenal experience. And I highly recommend for any artist listening, do it, because it opens up your audience, of course. Number one, opens up your audience and makes it more accessible, number one. But number two, for those who are not deaf or hard of hearing, it's still like a benefit. Like, it's like, whoa, like you never experienced, you never knew that this was possible until you put on the vest, until you put on the belt, until you, you know, it's worth it. It's worth it. It makes it's good for everyone.
The last thing I wanted to ask you, Travis, is how many hours a day you spend practicing or performing?
So this is a hyper personal question. So, okay. So I'll give like the stock answer of like, you know, 4 hours a day, 4 hours a day. That's the stock answer. But it doesn't shut off. It doesn't shut off. It, like, there's always something to do. I have a podcast, for example. I consider that podcast a part of my practice because I'm it's called the Tap Love Tour podcast. And I shamelessly write to other dancers and luminaries in the form that I have no business talking to. Like, yo, can we nerd out on this? And I ask these questions and they give me their answers. And then their answers inform my practice. You understand? It's just like, it never stops. The rhetoric, the story that I gave you before about my mission in tap dance, there's so much to do. There's so much to think about. And just to button it, it brings us back to the misleading bio, because even though the gigs that I've been a part of are substantial and wonderful and they're cherished memories, they don't fully encapsulate my mission. But tap dance does.
That was Travis Knight's tap and jazz dancer, originally from Montreal, now based in Ontario. He performed his show Ephemeral Artifacts at the Mai earlier this year. If you'd like to learn more about Travis or follow his love for dance in the podcast he mentioned, you can visit the Tap Love Tour on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Sarah De'Ay. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. This week's archive show looks back at some of my fave conversations so far from the year on movement, tap, stepping, and circus. Still to come, a Norwegian aerialist makes art with objects you'd find at the hardware store while forging intimacy high up in the air. For our second chat tonight, I want to revisit my conversation with Kyan Quealy. He was born in St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean, and while he was studying in the U.S., he discovered an art form, a form of percussive dancing known as stepping. The body becomes an instrument to create sound and rhythm. Rooted within the African-American fraternities and sororities at colleges, it draws on African traditions of storytelling and call and response. The performances are energizing and mesmerizing, and as Kyan soon learned, as much about community and pride as performance. As he'll explain here, his life soon brought him to Montreal, where he founded Montreal Steppers just 3 years ago, out of an existing cornerstone Afro-Canadian group. The troupe brings their work not only to the community, but to students at all levels, from elementary to university. Earlier this spring, Montreal Steppers performed a new show, The Route to Canada, at the Siegel Center. Kyan wrote the show. Here is our conversation. Tell me about your journey to stepping. How did you come to this dance form?
Well, I'm going to go back to when I was in university. So I left St. Kitts when I was 22. I was born and raised in the Federation of St. Kitts Nevis, which is in the Caribbean, beautiful island. And I went to school in upstate New York, so just in Plattsburgh, which is across the border from Canada. And while I was in university, I saw a gospel choir group, and that was the Plattsburgh State Gospel Choir, and they had a step team. So while attending the concert, the choir sang and then the step team stepped and they performed. I had seen stepped on television before, different movies, Stomp the Yard and different things, but it was my first time pretty much seeing it like live and up close. I thought it was so fascinating. I thought it was so interesting what they were doing, the rhythms they were creating. And then I said, I want to learn. I joined the team. I joined the choir. I would go on to take over the STEP team. One thing I focus on all the time is that I didn't realize that stepping would have connected me to part of my ancestors' history, part of my history that I was not aware of. And that's how I got into it. So since, just to put dates in all of this, this was in 2008 when I joined the STEP team, and then I was stepping up until 2013 in Plattsburgh. I came to Montreal in 2014, and then I was doing a little bit of stepping on and off. I thought it might be interesting to reintegrate STEP into my life, and I was volunteering at a high school, and the principal provided an opportunity for me to teach the high schoolers a routine. We did the routine, we did it at Vanier in the auditorium for a parents and children fundraiser event for the school. Everyone really loved it, super fascinating. And then the principal was just like, this is very impressive. I think you could explore ways in which you can use the art form to teach and educate. And I had done that a little bit in Plattsburgh, but that was the first time I think it kind of cemented in my mind what I could potentially do. So.
And I'm curious, had you had a performance background before you came to college and had this encounter seeing the Plattsburgh stepping crew?
No.
Wow. And so you saw the show and you joined a gospel choir and you joined a stepping group.
Yeah. I would say no. I growing up in the Caribbean, I mostly was active in church and different youth groups, and we would take opportunities to take the stage or say a little poetry or sing a little song. But to concept up, to put that in the context of like performance, I wouldn't. So it's actually fascinating. As you ask me that question, I'm just like, oh no, no, I didn't. And here I am just doing many of the things.
So not a trained performer per se, but someone who's used to being in front of people and also someone used to being in community and doing community organizing. But to me, that's also just so remarkable. And I think it's also testament to what it is to be involved in community arts, is that you can, pardon the pun, step up and get involved the way you have. Because you went from seeing a show, getting involved, and then moving countries and starting your own organization within a timeline of a couple of years, as you just explained. So tell us more about your history. You end up coming to Montreal from Plattsburgh. I'm sure you had a lovely time in Plattsburgh, but Canada, yeah. Montreal beckoned for family reasons.
Absolutely. So while in university, an incredible time at Plattsburgh, honestly. Some of my lifelong friends, incredible connections with professors, mentors, their families, love them to death. But while I was there, I was studying. I had a great time, but I met my wife. I was a part of the Plattsburgh State Gospel Choir. She came from Montreal with her family background in music and singing and performance and church, and she was looking for a choir. Saw the Plattsburgh State Gospel Choir, joined, boom. We are connected in 2010, the history unravels, we engage, we get married in 2014, we move to Montreal. And my wife had moved back to Montreal in 2013 while we were engaged, and she joins the Montreal Gospel Choir. And when I come to Montreal in 2014, I also joined the Montreal Gospel Choir. And the Montreal Gospel Choir, incredible group of people and supportive team. This makes up a majority of the folks that are in Montreal Steppers. And it's been incredible support from the Montreal Gospel Choir director and the members. And we continue doing choir together as a unit and then branch out to forming Montreal Steppers.
So two organizations deeply enmeshed together. I'm speaking with Kyan Quealy, who is the director of Montreal Steppers? That's an important question I should have figured out before.
Oh, that's all good. I'm always kind of like taking steps back when those terms come up, but I'm the founder, I'm the director of Montreal Steppers.
You referred earlier to discovering this art form and realized it harkens back to the past, to your ancestry. So what does stepping represent to you and to so many Black people?
It's so hard to put into just a few words what the art form really represents. And I think if we look back at the history very quickly, we're looking at this art form that would have started in the early 1900s, really based in historically Black universities and colleges. So post slavery, we are individuals, we're no longer enslaved. And this was a time period where they were building their own communities, pretty much starting over, starting from scratch, going to universities, establishing spaces in historically Black universities and colleges, and carving out areas for themselves where they can finally show their pride and their creativity and their resilience and explore their bodies to create something that never existed before. When individuals were taken from the continent of Africa through the Atlantic slave trade, they were bringing elements of dance expressions and movements. So many have said that there must have been strong ties with that, which is obvious. So some researchers have indicated that that art form would have been referred to as Juba, J-U-B-A, and that was stomping and hitting and moving and dancing, but not quite step. When we talk about stepping, that would have been birthed in the United States and really in the historically Black colleges and universities, where they really started to dive into community service, brotherhood, sisterhood, encouraging, supporting, lifting each other up. We're talking about establishing some of the first fraternities and sororities, Black fraternities and sororities, of course, that still have strong legacies that exist still today. Hundreds and thousands of Black men and Black women changing the world, really. So when I think about it, it's what a movement, what a way to use your bodies to tell your story as a means of social justice, as a means of resistance, as a means of expression. And stepping is so linked to what happened in 1739 in South Carolina, where there was the Stono Rebellion and they took away the use of the drums and instruments. And it gave way to people exploring and using their bodies even more to create, to express, to resist, because it was like, you're gonna take away the drum. And for individuals from the continent of Africa and African diaspora, the drum just didn't represent this instrument. You know, people in Africa explain the drum as having three spirits: the spirit of the animal whose skin is on the top of the drum, the spirit of the tree that is the body and base of the drum, and the spirit of the person who weaves that together. So it's not just this instrument. So when that was taken away, banned, it was this response to say, I will use my body now to continue telling my story. So when we do that, honestly, we're not even thinking about a performance per se. And that's my encouragement when folks come to the show on Saturday. We are coming to see a performance. We're performing for you. Fine. We get that. But it's beyond that. They weren't performing on the lights and in costumes and boots, and they were doing this for survival. So when we step on stage, it's this pride and representation of people who would have conquered and shared an incredible story. And we are so thrilled to step into that and be honored to share that.
And I'm thinking from the audience perspective, you're not just there to be entertained, but you're almost bearing witness.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's so ingrained in Black art and culture is this aspect of participation and invitation, which makes it so unique. So we'll be there and encouraging people to clap, stomp, and move with us. I know we're still in COVID, people will have masks. So, I mean, it's a limit to how much you can do. But at the same time, it's an invitation. So as you mentioned, it's really bearing witness. And we're incredibly proud to be on the stage showcasing this and telling a story and in our own way, creating history and adding to justice and resistance and change.
That is the voice of Kayan Quealy, who is the founder of the Montreal Steppers, founded in 2019. It's now 2022. You've made immense progress with your organization in the last couple of years. So does stepping have the same history in Canada, where you've chosen to make your home, the same kind of roots as you're describing to go centuries back in the U.S., and I assume also to perhaps a certain extent in the Caribbean, but you can correct me on that. So let's touch on that. But then I also want to touch on the story you're going to be telling this weekend, the route to Canada, and how you're using stepping as a form of storytelling.
So we had the privilege of connecting with the founding members of STEP in Canada just a few weeks ago. We met a group of lovely people. I am going back to my conversation on CKUT with Kim years ago, Soul's Perspectives, and we had a conversation, an interview about our inaugural show, The Roots of STEP, and he referenced being a part of Boots, the stepping group that existed in Montreal. So this February, we had the opportunity to sit down and have a conversation, a Facebook Live event, and we spoke with individuals who pretty much birthed stepping in Canada. So when we talk about the history of STEP in Canada, we know that there's a connection because the United States, they're our neighbors. So many people would have seen and been experiencing elements of that explosion of STEP through seeing it at historically Black universities and colleges, seeing it on television. So when I spoke to Natasha Cleary, who in 1991 was going to Vanier College, saw stepping on A Different World, which most people saw, went to her administration and said, I want to bring this to Vanier. Got the green light, created a team called Vanier Stompers in 1991, performed at the basketball games, and continued making that movement and shaping the history. Shortly after, there was Chris Bennett, who was also there, and Natasha appointed Chris as a person who would take over Vanier Stompers, and Chris, with the permission of Natasha, says, I want to change the name. So we're going to change it to Boots, with a connection to Gumboots in South Africa, which has a similar history to stepping, but expressions are a little bit different. And Boots will go on to have big boots, mini boots, boot boots, everybody. And just the response and the feedback from the Boots alumni on Facebook to us and the support they've given has been incredible. They built up a strong legacy, community, brotherhood, sisterhood that we still see exists. So they are the ones that actually started stepping in Canada, dating back to 1991. As we know that people were moving through migration from the United States, many people who would have been a part of colleges and universities and experiencing stepping would have also migrated to Canada. So you saw bits and pieces of it showing up. Doesn't carry that same specific history as you would see in the United States because that was its experience there. But as we reflect on the origins here, very similar in college, starting and looking for ways to, and I'm quoting Natasha here, they just wanted to make noise. They just wanted to make some noise and support their people. And that's really how it started. And when we talk about the route to Canada, we are looking at bringing specific information, showcasing the journey of Black people to Canada. So we are using STEP as that way and means and method of doing it, but it's also integrated with storytelling and song. So it's STEP, storytelling, and song. But we're looking at this big question that people sometimes ask that's really not a big question, but how did Black people get to Canada? And Canada has always had that reputation of we were the safe haven for people leaving the United States, which at one point, yes, but when we go back, people were extracted from the continent of Africa. They were also being brought to Canada as enslaved people. Canada, the United States, the Caribbean, South America. So Canada received their independence, well, not independence, sorry, the emancipation of slaves, and the abolishing of slavery happened in 1834 in Canada and not till 1865 in the United States. So that gap allowed for the Underground Railroad. So when we examine the main question of the route to Canada, we're looking at how did people get to Canada? Slavery, the Underground Railroad, that's migration, and then immigration later on as more people from different parts of the world immigrated here.
It's a much richer and much more complicated story than I think people lead themselves to believe. And it's not the pure kind of fantastical concept of it either, that Canada was some sort of wondrous slavery-free destination, right?
That's it. And I think that's the important thing too. We're looking to shed more light on this important piece of history. And we are telling that story as well of just the creativity, the influence, and the pride of what needed to happen for these people to come here and not just survive, but thrive. And many of us are living out those realities, those dreams of what they would have been holding, their hopes for what people who would come after them, how they would live, the way they would navigate the world. When I do workshops in schools, I always say, I'm very thankful for my ancestors, my families, the people who have paved the way for me to walk through the world a little bit easier than they would have had. It's not the easiest, but it's easier than they would have had. And we're not just satisfied with it being easier. We want to continue pushing for progress and change.
That was Kyan Quealy. He is the founder and director of Montreal Steppers, a troupe founded back in 2019. They performed their new show, The Road to Canada, at the Siegel Center earlier this year. To learn more, visit the troupe at montrealsteppers.com. I'm Sarah DeA, and you're listening to a retro episode of Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at ckut.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. The archive show this week is looking back at some of my fave conversations so far that focus on movement. We've covered tap, we've covered step, and now we look to circus. Hege Eriksdotter Osterfields is a circus artist from the south of Norway. She trained in Stockholm, Sweden, where she's currently based. Hege and her two colleagues traveled all the way to Montreal to take part in Montréal Complètement Cirque, the festival earlier this summer. Their show is titled Plast, and it's a spare yet shockingly effective three-way show. While Hege is a circus artist and the co-creator of Plast, she has recently retrained as an artisan of sorts. She creates frames for works of art. It's a pandemic pivot. But here she re-embraces her calling to perform intimate, complex, aerial work. I spoke with Norwegian circus artist Hege Eriksdotter Osterfields earlier this summer. I saw the show last night. I absolutely loved it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So this is my impression while I was watching the show. You're using a giant, what we might call a plastic tarp. There's ice, which people can make in their freezers at home. You're using flashlights. And, you know, the circus equipment is, it's tools, it's professional equipment, but essentially to the human eye, it looks like rope. And I kept thinking, these folks are doing the most extraordinary, interesting things with ordinary items, almost like buying a child a fancy toy, and then they end up playing with the box. Or you buy a cat, a giant cat kind of climbing thing, and they just sit in the box. That was my impression, full confession there. What do you think when I say something like that?
It's actually really interesting because it is something that we do talk about with our audience and also between ourselves, that all the material that we use, you can actually get in a hardware shop. So the plastic is just building plastic for like covering your furniture when you're painting or whatever you do at home. And the flashlights are also just from the hardware shop. We got some tape on the floor that you don't really see as an audience. It's from the same shop. And the circus equipment, the rigging ropes are definitely like special made for rigging, and we have some slings and stuff, and we have one circus rope, but this one white rope in the show, and you could actually also get that in the hardware shop. It depends like which type of shop you go to, but yeah, it's very actually normal material that we just started to play with to see what we could do with, I guess.
Now, was that in the interest of simplicity and accessibility, or was it something you always had wanted to do, or did it just kind of happen spontaneously?
That actually is a little bit from, so this show is based on a exam that I did, my project that I did when I was doing my master's in contemporary circus practices a few years back. And at the time, I was really interested in how I could make things connect. And one way of creating connection for me was to allow the audience to have a personal connection to the material I was working with. So I started to look at things that you can actually just have access to easily. And plastic, obviously, you can buy everywhere in all types of forms. And the same with that white rope and some other like all the other things. And at the time during the masters, I was actually building more like an installation, and I would tell people that the material were like from the hardware shop or it was this and that. And it just means that when people look at it and they see something extraordinary going on, rather than thinking, oh, that must be special made for circus, they then automatically have a connection because they're like, oh, but I have that at home. Maybe I don't do the same with it at home, but you have an instant connection to it. You understand it in a different way. And in a way, when you say that, you take away the magic. It's not just made for circus, but the magic becomes in the connection that the audience actually has by themselves with the material.
I'm so fascinated by this because, of course, yeah, you can make ice cubes at home and here you are balancing giant blocks of ice. I wanted to go back to the plastic because that is a huge touchstone for the show. When we walk into the tent, the circus space, we are presented with this, it's almost like a shroud or a scrim of this plastic. And I can't help but that my brain wanders and I think, oh my goodness, like, does this get damaged? How do they travel with this? Do they clean it after the show? So you said you got this at a hardware store, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So yeah, actually, this is also something we had to like talk about and consider a bit, because we have this huge plastic sheet, obviously, in the show that we use a lot. And it's thin plastic, so it's going to wear, it's going to tear. And we have cut the edges a few times because that's where it gets torn more easily. And we have reinforced it with extra tape and everything that we can do. But every now and again, like, it depends where we're performing. But recently we also tried to do this show outdoors and it was super windy. And it was a great experience, but it also meant that sometimes the wind would like take hold of the plastic and try to lift it and fly it away. And I was holding on and I tore holes in the plastic. So we used to have a huge roll of this, like many meters. And we realized right before coming here that we had used the last bit. So we were like contemplating, should we get a new one just for this? Because it's like a special performance for us to do here in Montreal, because we come from overseas, we're from Scandinavia. It's like a huge thing for us to travel over here. Like, should we get a brand new plastic for this? But in the end, they didn't have the kind that we wanted in the shop. And also we decided it's probably better that we actually also reuse what we have. So we cleaned it up and cut the edges and retaped it and tried to make it look presentable, I guess. But I mean, in the end, it is plastic. It's thin plastic. It's going to wear and tear. At some point, you have to sort of realize that, okay, it goes in the recycle bin and you get a new piece. But we try to use them for as long as we can.
Oh, that's great to hear. And also, I guess on an environmental level, you are reusing the material that you do have. Yeah. But it is delicate, but almost in an artistic kind of way. That is the voice of Hege Eriksdottir Osterjils, who is an artist. Did I get it?
Yes, it did.
She is an artist and the co-creator of Plast, which is on now at the La Tohu Underly Escapade, L'Escapade tent for Montréal Complètement Silk. And it's a delightful show. You just mentioned that you came from overseas. How exciting is it to be in Montreal right now presenting the show?
Oh, it's super exciting, actually. And to be honest, like, me and my colleague, Caroline, who's also the other aerialist, we're two aerialists in this show, and she's the other one. And we had to sort of ignore the fact that we were coming here to play for a long time. We've known for a long time we would be here. But just because it's like the navel of circus in a way, you know, this is the headquarters of Cirque du Soleil. You have Cirque Loise and you have the Seven Fingers, all these like famous companies that we see every now and again when they come abroad or we see them on YouTube. So it was like a huge thing for us to come over here. And even though we know that we have been invited here because people want us to be here, it's like, oh, you know, the technique here is so high. What are we going to present and all these things? So in a way, we ignored it for a long time. And then when we came here, we just had the best time of seeing so much circus. And everything is so different from what we do. And that also makes it like a little bit scary, but mostly just really nice to be able to present something that is different. So it's so far, it's been just a really joyful experience.
So this isn't just a chance to perform and reach new audiences. Like, as a career kind of moment, it's special for you because you're getting to see other performers and to meet other performers as well.
Definitely. Yeah, because we already seen so many other shows and they're truly amazing. But also just to be here and to experience the artistic scene here and to see what we have only seen on YouTube before is really amazing for us. And it's inspiring and scary and lovely all in one huge pot. It's really great.
So you trained in contemporary circus back home. So what is the circus scene like in Scandinavia? Is it an accessible form of art? Is that something people go see very readily?
Yes and no. It's a bit of a mix. Scandinavia consists of a few countries, and the group that I'm in, ENT, we're based in Sweden, and Sweden has quite a strong circus community, particularly in Stockholm, where I live, or we all live, actually. But both me and Carolina, we come from Norway, and the circus scene there is very, very small. We were actually talking about how many people we think do circus there, and I think it's less than 100. That's how small it is. I mean, we're also just 5 million in the whole country, so we're a small country. Right. But in Sweden, there is a lot more happening, and you also have Cirkus Cirkör, which is like a huge, not just a company, but like a whole building with residencies, and, you know, they're similar to what I'm guessing Tohu is here. So they organize their own shows, but also host other shows, which is great. So the circus scene there in Sweden is a little bit bigger and easier to access. And it also makes the audience then more used to seeing circus because it is more accessible. Whereas in Norway, it's quite rare that you get to see circus still. So yeah, it's sort of yes and no to that question, I guess.
it's big, but it's small, but big, but small.
yeah, exactly.
That is the voice of Hege Eriksdottir Osterjils, who is a performer and a co-creator of Plast Annette L'Escapade at La Tohu, part of Montréal Complètement Cirque. I wanted to turn back to Plast, this excellent show, a three-hander, if we can call it that. As you were saying, you and Carolina are the acrobats, the aerialists, and you have a third person who's playing music as well. How did all three of you come together and decide to work together?
Oh, this so the third person, just to say that firstly, is Love Kjellson, and he's the musician in our show. And in 2016, I had just moved to Sweden. I was living in Belgium before that. And I started this master's course, and I dove into this project of mine. And I just happened to be training with Caroline, and Love was in the same room playing music, just hanging out. And we just realized how much we enjoy spending time together and just like playing and having fun and sort of creating, but that was not to create a show. It was just for fun creating together. So I asked Caroline first, like sort of as a joke, like, oh, if you have nothing to do, do you want to join my exam project? And she was like, yeah, I will do that. And then a week later, I got an email from Love who said, actually, do you also need a musician? Because I got nothing to do around that time. Can I join? And that was the start of the three of us creating what became Plast together. And then when we had done the presentation for my exam project, we also just realized that we really enjoyed working in that universe that we had created together, but that I spent 2 years like writing and theorizing around. And also that we enjoyed working together. So they were actually the ones suggesting we continue with the project and turn it into a show. And so we decided to do so. And here we are with Plast.
Tell me about that universe that you said that you're in a kind of special world together. How would you describe that? I assume it's a playful kind of space.
It's a playful kind of space, but it's also, I mean, you've seen the show, it's very poetic. So we sort of like realized that we have a very similar way of thinking and being when we're being aesthetic. Like we like both poetic, but also funny stuff. In this particular piece, it's more poetic than funny. And Love, like what was so amazing with creating with him is that both me and Caroline could be like, hey, we want this and that feeling. Do you think that you could create something like that? And he would like hit and stroke his violin and do all sorts of noises on the synthesizer. And we were just like amazed by what it sounded like. And it made us move to that and being created, like sort of like drawn into this bubble of poetic, dramatic, epic. I don't know how to explain it really, but just like a lot of emotions, but in the most simple way. That's maybe the best way I can describe it. And that's also how, because we enjoyed his music, and I guess he also does, obviously, like his music is so fantastic. So when we talk about our show, we actually talk about it being partially a circus experience and partially a concert, like music experience, because that's how literally crazy beautiful the music is, to me at least, in the show.
If I had to pick a word to describe Lua's music, it's ethereal. And when you walk in, he's vocalizing in this kind of very high, kind of almost makes me think of the elvish music in Lord of the Rings or something like
that.
But he's also using a loop machine and a synthesizer and playing with the violin, which gives it kind of like a very more folk-like and very raw feeling to it.
Yeah, it definitely moves between this like electronic feeling and into this like traditional music on the violin, but still very modern in a way. But the overall feeling is exactly what you say. It's quite ethereal, which I really love. I love playing with like the emotions of like going between harmony and disharmony, where you're like a little bit off balance in yourself. And then when you find the balance through the music or what you see, it's like for me, at least, I connect quite well with myself and with what I look at, because I'm like, I'm allowed to be a little bit scared and off balance. And then I'm allowed to also land in myself and, you know, like, oh, connect again. And I feel like the music is definitely this. It carries the performance a lot this way. Like without his music in that particular way that he makes it, I think it will be a very, very different show.
I have to agree. There's so many moments of, I was going to say delicatesse in French, delicate moments, but also kind of scary moments where things were kind of, felt like to me eerie and where you were doing a balancing moment or holding on to each other, like so high up in the sky. You know, I was kind of wondering about what kind of message you wanted to send to the audience. And when we incorporate also the fact that you're using ice and there's water dripping at a certain point,
like
what is the message you send overall with Past?
So what we wanted to sort of talk about, without obviously using words, because we don't use words in this show, but when me and Carolina started to create the material for the double rope together, we had two rules for ourselves. One was that we didn't want to make any huge tricks to impress. The focus was not to impress. And the other one was to find as many moments as we could between us to embrace each other and just have moments of looking at each other, embracing each other with a gaze or look. And then when we started to create this, it was this simple, because we don't do big tricks. It's quite simple, everything that we do. But then I added the ice. So I have a huge, not a huge, but like a 15 centimeters by 15 centimeters block of ice on my head that I balance when I go up in the rope. And then Carolina joins me in the rope and we do a simple routine. But as soon as I have the ice on my head, the focus is no longer, I think at least, on the tricks. It's on the balance between us and therefore also the communication between me and Carolina to see if we can manage this. And more so communication between us, it's definitely between the care for each other. We have to care a lot for each other to make that balance happen, to make that communication happen so the ice doesn't drop. And then at the end, we choose to drop it, but that's a whole other story. But we wanted to create material where we could connect with each other rather than the audience being blown away by huge tricks. We wanted to see the human connection.
That was Norwegian circus artist Hege Eriksdotter Osterfjells. She was in town this summer to perform her show Plast at Montreal Complètement Cirque. You have been listening to a retro episode of Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Tonight you heard the tap artist Travis Knights, Kyan Quilly, the founder of Montreal's own stepping troupe, Montreal Steppers, and Norwegian aerialist Hege Eriksdottir Osterfjells. A very big thank you to my guests. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under the archives. Thank you to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator, for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. Have fun. Stay safe. Up next is Grey Matters.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Welcome to the August 11th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we have an alternative radio classic that we're rebroadcasting. It's entitled Second Thoughts on the First Amendment. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado on August 25th, 1989. The lecturer is Howard Zinn. He was Professor Emeritus at Boston University and was perhaps the United States' premier radical historian. He's author of many books, most famous being A People's History of the United States. He passed away in January of 2010. So, without any further ado, here is a lecture by Howard Zinn for his centenary. He was born in 1922. Second Thoughts on the First Amendment.
The biggest problem with freedom of speech really is the economic problem. Problem of who has the money to speak out, to reach large numbers of people. And then there's an additional problem. Suppose you even overcame that and you had the resources.